So, you know how everyone seems to be angry a lot of the time, especially on the internet? A while back, I was watching one of Drew Gooden's videos, and I'm going to include a clip of something he said that I think about a lot.
I feel like there's this anger that's seeped into every part of the internet, and it's so hard to avoid without just staying off of it altogether. Like, you'll see the most innocuous comment in the world that for some reason has 97 replies, and you're like, huh, what happened
And the
here?
most recent reply will be like,
no, I'm not the one defending genocide. You're the
And it's
one.
like, huh? How did they even, what? Who even brought that up?
And some of this comes down to algorithms and certain industries who stand to make a profit off of an angry population, but not too angry, which I am going to talk about more later. But I also want to go into how and why anger has been spreading, not just online, but also in real life with real consequences. And at what point does this become dangerous enough to address with individual and collective solutions? By the way, this video is part of a larger series I have on my channel about how the modern versions of seven deadly sins show up in society today, minus religion, and the topic of today being wrath. Even though they're often innocuous, you don't have to look for a second on the internet to find an argument. In this study, when they asked people to recall a recent debate, about half of them said the one that they thought of was online. I don't know if I've gone a single day not finding a fight in the social media comments over the past few years, and yet another interesting finding was that the different groups all overestimated the amount of debates that the average American is having, and in some scenarios, by a lot, people aren't actually reporting doing much debate themselves, and yet we all feel like debate is everywhere. So, is it a small percent of the population who are doing a lot of debating, and the rest of us are exposed to it but not usually participating, just like witnessing a loud minority? Whether you're doing the debate or just watching it, both can be pretty anger-inducing. And when I say debate, I am using it very loosely, and maybe that's part of the problem. I don't expect most people to have watched much real debate or be familiar with deconstructing logical fallacies, so I don't expect most casual online debates to be productive. Usually, both parties in internet debates are unprepared and passionate and resort to ad hominem attacks and straw manning, but perhaps most importantly, entered the discussion with a closed mind. Two people started both believing they're right and unwilling to consider otherwise, and in such a sloppy, impersonal setting, it's going to end up with more or less no change, and maybe just each side hating the other a little bit more. So, why do so many small agreements turn into dumpster fires? I can think of at least two reasons. One being that people are more polarized today than ever in their opinions. And just to be clear, perceived polarization is larger than actual polarization, but actual is still up. And I know this might seem politics exclusive, but when you think about so many things that are called politics today, so many of them are social and cultural and ideological, like things like how parents should parent and how bosses should treat employees and preserving the health of our planet. And when you feel really strongly about big issues, it's easy to get into the habit of letting those strong opinions apply to the little things too, like just falling into always being on guard, always ready to defend your opinions, even if the stakes are so low and it doesn't really matter. Reason number two of why everything turns into discourse has to do with the loneliness epidemic and people being starved for attention. This study looked into the motivation behind trolling, and A main reason why trolls say they do it is for fun. They're bored and they're online and they're lacking connection. We all know about the dopamine rushes we get when our posts get lots of engagement. So a troll could post something like this and the comment section is flooded in a bad way, but at least it's attention. But trolls can also lie for good attention and post something like this, and the comments are loaded with support and sympathy for that poster, which they can really feel even if they made it up. Trolls are not the only people who have discovered that posting rage bait or otherwise provoking content gets them attention. Companies are painfully aware of this, and they understand it better than trolls do. Businesses like Google and Amazon, who make money from selling products and services, but also through advertising, and social media companies like Meta, who rely almost exclusively on advertising, have the same goal in mind. Get as many people to see as many ads as humanly possible. So they have researched a lot about what gets people to look and to keep looking, not just passively, but actively. And some other companies who want eyeballs and engagement are ones who rely on donations and volunteers, like nonprofits, who their goal is to get people to care about a certain issue. Their revenues are like nothing in comparison to the tech giants, but their strategies are kind of the same. Like, you ever see those ads by nonprofits showing starving animals trying to make you upset? And then for a company like Facebook, every time you try and give it another chance, you go on there and it's just a cesspool of toxic negativity. Both of those experiences probably make you want to rage, and it's because bad feelings feel stronger than good feelings. In general, people are more compelled to act, to comment on something that makes them angry, saying, this is bullshit, rather than to comment on something that they like, saying, hey, this is cool. Like, imagine you're at a dinner party, and you're hanging out with a group of people, and you're not really feeling like talking, you're kind of tired, and the group's discussing climate change and how we should be doing more for the earth, and you agree. It's pretty easy to just sit back and not add anything to the conversation, just listen. But if someone starts talking about how clean energy is a waste of time and money, how we're doing too much for the environment, and you disagree, the urge to jump in and say something feels a lot stronger. So anger also leads to more online engagement. Not that long ago, a whistleblower came forward about Facebook and revealed the company is well aware of the fact that inflammatory content is prioritized because it makes people angry, and those angry people become more engaged users and therefore can be served more ads, and then Facebook can make a bigger profit. There is a balance, though. If companies allow that rage pit to fester for too long and the vibe becomes too negative, users will start to leave. And just look at what happened to Twitter. People will only tolerate a certain level of scrolling through shit that they hate, which admittedly is quite a lot, before eventually they decide that this place isn't worth it. Since regular people and companies have discovered that anger-inducing content gets the most attention, it has led to a cycle that feeds on itself. Anger breeds more anger. And there's this old video by CGP Grey that is worth watching that makes an analogy of ideas being like germs, and their goal is to spread among as many people as possible. One of the better ways to do that is to be an angry idea, as that's proven to be shared more. And as it's shared, it is slightly changed along the way to become more toxic, and kind of like the game of telephone. And that's basically the origin of fake news. Like, there's some kid who goes to school and someone finds out that they're a furry. They like to dress up as an animal. And maybe the popular kids play a prank on that kid by bringing a litter box to school to make fun of them. And then some students tell their parents, and it gets twisted into this story of how kids are identifying as cats, and the public education system is enabling them, and look at how these transgender kids are spiraling out of control. But this isn't real. There's no truth to that story. There are no litter boxes in schools. But that is a really juicy story, and it's really appealing to share on Facebook if you're a 50-year-old Karen. And all of your friends read it, and they're outraged about it as well, so they share it with their friends too. Being united on hating the same things is a really powerful way to build strong ties within groups, and it might even be more powerful than being united on liking the same things. Having things in common, whether it's shared positive beliefs or negative, is how in-groups are formed. Humans have been working together and cooperating since we lived together in the caves. It didn't take much for us to realize that we're better as groups than alone. Jonathan Haidt talks about this in a book called The Righteous Mind. Groups compete with other groups, and that competition favors groups who are made up of true team players. But there is also an innate selfishness within humans. And that combo of selfishness and the fact that groups nowadays can grow into the millions means that most groups actually spend more time fighting within themselves than going against the other side. So, what starts as just anger between someone who thinks the earth is round and someone who thinks it's flat grows into many subgroups. With much more than just the original anger, all fighting between themselves. Another perfect example is the many split-offs of religion over time. An argument between a Christian and a Muslim can be just as fiery as one between a Christian and a non-believer, even though you would think that the two members of Abrahamic religions would probably have a lot more in common. And it's not surprising that as these divisions grow wider and people become angrier, that we start to become numb to it. Obviously, news and informational content is one major culprit when it comes to inciting rage within the masses, like this study that looked at news headlines between 2000 and 2019 and saw a consistent increase in negatively charged language, including anger, fear, disgust, and neutrality, is getting harder and harder to find. News sources disproportionately cover violent crimes far more than other stories, and that would explain why Americans believe that crime is up both locally and nationally every year, despite sources pretty much agreeing that crime has been steeply decreasing since the 90s in most areas. However, one of those areas is not mass shootings, specifically school shootings. And I'm too young to remember like Virginia Tech, but I do remember Sandy Hook. The media coverage around that event was crazy for so long, and it still is happening even today because of this asshole. On the one hand, I think that an issue like this deserves significant attention and needs to be taken seriously. And there's probably a lot to unpack here when it comes to personal anger turning into violence and aggression towards others. And in order for people to study the best courses of action to take to stop these kinds of things from happening, a lot of people need to be firstly aware and secondly, angrily calling for change. And then on the other hand, Parkland happened, and Santa Fe, and Uvalde, and it's like, okay, now one just happens one after the other, and it feels so normal, and school shootings just become this one big sad joke, and they're just another item on this long list of horrible things that are happening that we have to care about. But we're all becoming desensitized because of the constant coverage with the same old talking points, which sounds so sick to say. And it's not just news where violence feels omnipresent, it's also entertainment and fictional content. I checked the most popular Netflix shows by most hours watched in the first 28 days, and number one is Squid Game. And don't get me wrong, I am not at all immune to enjoying dark, twisted TV shows with violent content. I actually love Squid Game, but it's a messed up show. It's like survival dystopian horror with some gore, and we all clearly hate to think about something like that, and yet we also all clearly love it because it's number one. And don't even get me started on the rise of true crime. Number four on that list was the Jeffrey Dahmer series, which was pretty disturbing. There's podcasts and documentaries and YouTubers. I find it all so hideously entertaining, but I'm sure there are negative effects on my brain. It's like a hate-watching addiction because content that makes you angry is so engaging. Something like Making a Murderer or Dear Zachary, it hooks you and shocks you with a crazy crime and then makes you want to rage out at the injustice within the legal case. So really, no matter the type of media, whether it's fact or fiction, anger is a popular topic, and the more we're exposed to it, the less of an impact it has. Going back to mass shootings for a second, I want to take some time to talk about the problem of angry men. And yes, I am singling out men to talk about this because 98% of mass shooters are men. And research suggests they tend to externalize their problems more and blame others and express their anger in a more aggressive way. Not to say that men experience anger more often or more intensely than women on a biological level. It's just they're more likely to show it in a way that makes them seem like they're angrier. When women express anger, they're perceived as having a lower social status and just generally less competent. So we're less likely to be aggressive or even assertive in any type of setting for fear of the consequences. And to be honest, the feeling of anger by itself is not really the problem. It's when it's expressed in a dangerous way. And it does seem like some research shows that men having more aggressive tendencies is on a biological level, like there's just something different in their brains. So we can at least partly blame nature, but the nurture side, which we have more control over, could definitely use some improvement. There has been a lot of strides over the years when it comes to gender stereotypes and feeling like you have to fit a certain mold, but culturally there is still a ways to go. For a very long time, and starting in childhood, there has been a ton of subtle and direct messages to boys to hide their emotions. Emotions are girly, and that's bad. According to society, anger is the only approved outlet for boys. It's like the main emotional exception that is okay for them to show outwardly. And it's more than just suggesting men are okay to show anger and shouldn't show sadness. It's also about them feeling like they have to push down their positive feelings too. And this feels like, I don't know, a weird example, but like if you try and imagine your parents, if you have a mom and a dad, think of your dad in a really happy moment, and then think of your mom in a really happy moment. Who seems more joyful? If you're interested in hearing more about how the pressures on boys to be this particular
brand of aggressively masculine causes mental health problems, I saw this cool documentary about that called The Mask You Live In. I suspect we may start to see some of this change over time as parenting styles start to do away with some of the older language of boys don't cry and suck it up and be a man, but only time will tell. Obviously, when anger causes people to lash out and hurt others or themselves, it's not a good thing, but I do think anger has its place in time. Anger can actually be useful when it's responded to in the right way. It can be a motivator. Frustration can be fuel for people to overcome challenges and achieve their goals. I found it really interesting that this study opened up with a quote by Malcolm X, who made a lot of progress in the civil rights movement, but is often overshadowed by the champion of peaceful movement, Martin Luther King Jr. Usually when people are sad, they don't do anything. They just cry over their condition. But when they get angry, they bring about a change. I talk a lot on my channel about problems that society's dealing with today and try to make some suggestions for what would bring about change. So this is something that I think about. If anger and even aggression is necessary to really make those big changes. Organizers of movements want to raise awareness, and they're probably aware that if there is some amount of aggression or civil disruption, that their cause will gain more attention than if it was to be 100% nonviolent. And some of that will be bad attention, but maybe it's worth it on the whole. If there's a great injustice, how effective is asking nicely compared to some of the more drastic tactics with rage behind them? But like, when I think about an issue that I care about, veganism, there's the PETA protesters who are filled with fury and they're throwing paint on people, screaming, and there's content creators who are perpetually calm and logical in their approach, talking about harm reduction and caring for animals. And I know which one persuaded me when I went vegan far more than the other side, but I also came across some research showing that a riot may be more effective than a peaceful protest. Like after Rodney King, the LA riots in the 90s, there was a significant shift in support for liberal policies at the polls. And after George Floyd in 2020, this study shows an increase in support for police reform, largely because the movements for that were mostly nonviolent, but not completely, and that might have helped them with the cause. And this one suggests that nonviolent protests are effective at mobilizing supporters, but more disruptive ones can motivate policy support among resistant people. Long story short, I found a lot of different conclusions, so all I can really say here is that I do think anger is a useful tool when it comes to fueling large-scale cultural change, because I think passion is going to get us much further than apathy, but I can't really say where the line is of when it ends up hurting your cause more than helping it. So, like with any emotion, it's about balance. We don't need to try and get rid of anger, just channel it into something constructive and check ourselves if it's turning from regular frustration into wrath. Suppressing it isn't the answer, but neither is letting it loose unrestricted. On an individual level, I know this sounds kind of silly, but a lot of people go through life feeling negative emotions and never really giving any deep thought as to why. So if you're able to get in touch with your emotions and admit, hey, I'm angry about something, that's step one. And it sounds so easy, but that's the whole thing with powerful emotions. They cloud your brain, and when you're infuriated, you can't think logically. So rather than trying to address it in the moment, you have to put in the time separately
thinking about how you express anger and if it's in healthy ways or not. This depends on the source of the emotion, of course, but maybe a small problem can be dealt with by venting to a friend or going on a run. And a bigger problem can ignite you to find a cause to fight for, which can actually be really fulfilling and a great way to channel your anger. So let me know what you think about this topic in the comments, and thanks for watching.